Turning this evening to the book of the prophet Daniel, chapter 8 and verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And our subject is Satan's methods in the last days. And Daniel tells us in this first verse that this vision came 2 years after the vision recorded in Daniel chapter 7. The Babylonian Empire is very soon to fall. Belshazzar had an extremely short reign, and this is described as a vision given in the second year of his in the third year of his reign. So they can't be long to go before that great last night, which we've already studied and seen of. So really there is little point in the vision containing much reference to the Babylonian Empire. It's going. This vision is going to explain to Daniel things that will come to pass before the coming of Messiah, before the fulfilling of the great promises that Messiah will come. So he's only going to be told now about those empires that remain, the middle empires at any rate. And in verse 2, I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace or the citadel. There is debate about how it should be translated, the castle or the palace. But in any case, Shushan, the palace, probably wasn't built at the time this vision was given. Daniel is only there in the vision. Of course, he's in service in the Babylonian Empire, and Shushan, the palace, is in Persia. And Persia is an enemy of the Babylonians. So there's no way that Daniel would have been there. And that palace, that castle was not yet built. It would be, in due course, the summer capital of the Median-Persian Empire. And so it's quite remarkable that the vision not only speaks of future things, it actually places Daniel in a place that wasn't built at the time of the giving of the vision. I saw in a vision. He's there in spirit, as it were. He's there in the vision, not in reality. And it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Ulai, which may very well be the great canal, which had been dug very, very wide, which ran right past that fortress palace that was to be built by the Persian Median Empire. And in verse 3, well, I come to a first heading. Here is a close-up of the two middle empires before the coming of Christ. The first is the one that's about to fall, the Babylonian Empire. The second is the empire of the Medes and the Persians. The third will be the empire of the Greeks. And something is going to arise out of the Greek Empire, which is going to be very troublesome to the Jews, and also a symbol of what is to happen in the very last days. So the Roman Empire is not mentioned in this particular vision. We've seen the four empires twice before, but now we're going to see just two. Well, verse 3, then I lifted up mine eyes. It's a waking vision. Daniel peers and looks into the vision. It isn't a night vision. And saw, and behold, see, there stood before that river a ram which had two horns. Well, a little later, it's explained to us what the ram is. And the ram is the empire of the Medes and the Persians. It hadn't yet come into existence. The Medes are one horn and the Persians are the other. The Persians, of course, eclipsed the Medes, and their portion was much greater and their conquests more numerous. And although the two were allied, they're seen by Daniel, even before this happens, as two unequal horns. Nobody ever thought in the time of the Babylonians that this would happen, that Babylon would fall to such relatively obscure and minor people as the Medes and the Persians. Of course, they were growing in power, but still there was confidence right to the end of Babylon that Babylon could never be overpowered or fall. But here it is in this vision. It's going to be supplanted. And this time, the Median-Persian Empire is seen as a ram. That's interesting. Previously, it's been a bear. Well, Babylon was the lion. The Median-Persian Empire was a bear, a ferocious bear. Now it's but a ram. That's interesting. A ram doesn't sound anything like as ferocious as a bear. Why has the animal imagery been scaled down? Because now this is a message to the faithful among the Jews, to the remnant, to faithful, believing Jews. It's comfort for them. Up to chapter 7, and including chapter 7, well, that has not been in Hebrew. That's been in Aramaic. That's a message to the whole wide world. Empires will arise and fall. But now, Daniel switches to the sacred language of Hebrew, as though to tell us he's speaking to the sacred people. He's speaking to the church, to believers. Now, as far as they are concerned, the ferocity and the aggression of the Medo-Persian Empire and the empire of the Greeks that will supplant it, follow it, will be nothing like as serious as the aggression towards outsiders, towards the world in general. Why, the Median-Persian Empire will be ferocious to the world, but now these chapters are for the church. What is a bear to the world is a ram to you. It's pretty bad, but it's nothing like as bad. It's going to be something much more serious later on. So the imagery changes. I just want to point out there is tremendous intelligence in this book and the deployment of the different figures. They are all sensible and calculated and carefully chosen to indicate these things, worthy of deep study. It's not just a bundle of images that conflict and change, as we might think if we read this book as an unbeliever. And I think this is random. One set of pictures suddenly changes into another. But no, a different set of animals now. But in verse 3, this is the Median-Persian Empire, the ram with two horns. The two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. That is exactly what happened, of course, with the Persians eclipsing the Median part. Verse 4, and I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. Can't go eastward because it is as east as you can get in the world of those days. So that no beasts might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. So it was ferocious, this empire, but not so bad to the Jews. After all, they got religious liberty. The Edict of Cyrus, and they were served by Daniel, who no doubt was steering things a little too in favour of the Jews and for their comfort and safety. And the Edict of Cyrus proclaimed liberty for Jews to return to their homeland and to rebuild. And a sizable minority went, and Jerusalem was re-established and the land of Judah, and these things developed. So that empire was quite reasonable, very reasonable towards the Jewish people, but very ferocious to other neighbours. Well, at the end of verse 4, he did Cyrus and his successors according to his will and became great. Then, verse 5, these are the two middle empires. We're reminded of them with a few extra details. And as I was considering, it's a waking vision, and Daniel now considers what he's seen. The picture is dying before his eyes, and he's thinking about it, and suddenly it seems to come to life again and renew. And as I was considering, look, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground, which anyone can see, is the speed of this he-goat. This is Greece. Why, the explanation will follow. But this is the empire of Greece. It's Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great conquered massively, usually with smaller armies than the people he conquered, because the goat had a notable horn between his eyes, which might seem to be symbolic of great intelligence, the way he went about it. He carried out reconnaissance, he planned, and then he struck with great force at a weak point of the enemy. And so, with considerably smaller armies, he always conquered. And so that's a reminder of the Empire of Greece, the third of the empires, the second of these middle ones. And verse 6, and he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, verse 7, and he was moved with choler, with indignation against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. There was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him. And all that is very, very close to what ultimately came to pass. And verse 8, I'm skimming quickly, therefore the he-goat waxed very great, but when he was strong, Alexander the Great died very young, 33. The great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now that took time. It didn't happen immediately, but in due course, four of Alexander's generals more or less divided up the empire between them. And so you can see, when you read these details, how it is that unbelieving scholars have always made up their mind that the book of Daniel must have been written far later than the Bible places it, because he couldn't possibly know all these things. And they don't believe in prophecy, and prophecy couldn't be anything like as accurate as this. So they park Daniel way down the timetable as a much, much later composition. But that's just speculation and unbelief. Anyway, these four notable horns, one of the descendants of one of the rulers of the regions of Greece, the Greek Empire, verse 9, out of one of them came forth a little horn, something relatively small. You might think an obscure king at first, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east, and this is the significant part, end of verse 9, toward the pleasant land. And the pleasant land, obviously, in Daniel's writing, refers to Israel, refers to the people of God. This is the little horn, small at first. Who is this little horn? Well, a few verses later, we're told what the two beasts that preceded it are, and so it's quite easy to see who the little horn is. The little horn is Antiochus Epiphanes, a Hellenistic Greek king arising out of part of the Empire of Greece, who unusually and terribly was vindictive and hostile towards the Jews and invaded and attacked Israel and devastated Jerusalem and murdered, according to traditional record, some 40,000 Jews and took into slavery 40,000 others. He nearly conquered Egypt, but didn't succeed in that. But he was particularly vicious, vindictive, and cruel toward the Jews. And all commentators, bar just one or two among such an army of commentators, have always said this is unquestionably, incontrovertibly Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth. So here you read about him. Verse 9, one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the pleasant land. Some translate it the glorious land. Others translate it the desired land. But when you consider the author is Daniel, he's obviously referring in his own terms to the promised land, to the land of the Jews and to Judah. Verse 10, and it waxed great even to the host of heaven. Now, host of heaven, you might think, reading our King James Version, this refers to the angels or to heavenly powers. But of course it doesn't, because host is used in the book of Daniel to describe the Jews. It's a term he uses to them, the people of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and some of the stars. And Daniel also uses stars in Daniel 12 and verse 3, for example. He uses stars to describe eminent Jews, and so does Jeremiah. So this 10th verse refers at the first level to his having destroyed people of great eminence and significance. When you know what Antiochus Epiphanes did in Jerusalem and how he committed the terrible sacrilegious acts in the temple, and he abolished and did away with Jewish worship, and he brought in heathen worship, pagan worship, and the very worst of it, and he had pigs offered in the temple, which was a terrible thing in the Jewish house of God, of course, and he did everything, put his own statue in the of his own favorite god in the temple. When you consider what he did, well, there were Jews that compromised, and they actually carried out his worship and his wishes. And there were others that stood their ground and they wouldn't have it. And they paid the price. And I imagine these are the people who are mostly referred to. It waxed great, this little horn, verse 10, even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. What a statement. The prince of the host, the God of Judah, the God of the people of God. He magnified himself. Well, yes, he was the first king ever, Antiochus, to make coins with his own image and with the claim to divinity on the image. And he magnified himself, and he seemed to get great pleasure in sacking the temple and denigrating the religion of the Jews, as though challenging God. You see, I am divine also, and I can get away with this. I can trample them underfoot. I hate them, and I can do as I please. And verse 12, difficult to understand. An host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. And the best sense is probably that he killed many. They were given over into his hand because they resisted him in the abolition of the daily sacrifice in the temple. And all this lasted between 6 and 7 years, this most fierce ever persecution and hostility to the Jews during the Old Testament period, with all imaginable cruelties. And Antiochus Epiphanes carried them out. Well, nevertheless, he seemed to prosper for this time. It practiced and prospered. He got away with it. There didn't seem to be, for a long time, any divine action against him. So now verse 13 brings us, and we'll apply this in just a moment, to another heading, the angelic bystanders in the vision, and the part that they play. Verse 13, then I heard one saint, which you could equally translate here, Holy One, it's obviously a reference to angels, who are there present in the vision. One saint or angel speaking, and another saint or angel said unto that certain saint which spake, how long, it's a rhetorical question, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice? How long will the temple be desecrated and the worship be discontinued and pagan worship put in its place? How long the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? How long the persecution and the killings and so on? Verse 14, he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Well, that's very strange, that figure in verse 14, because it does rather roughly correspond to the period of the persecutions of Antiochus Epiphanes, which were between 6 and 7 years. It does roughly correspond. And yet the other figures in the book of Daniel are all symbolic. And it's mysterious that one should be out of step and should be a rather literal figure for the time. And so many are inclined to say it can't be intended as a literal figure, even if it does look about right, because Daniel's figures are usually symbols and usually mysteries and usually have another significance. So I can't tell you the answer to that, but it does happen to be roughly the period between of the time of the persecution. And verse 15, it came to pass, when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. Well, it is an angel, as it turns out. Just in case we might think it's a theophany, it does turn out to be an angel. But why now does the angel appear as a man? Well, this is a small aside, but there are many clues in the passage to this. The effect of this vision on Daniel was so tremendous, it made him quite ill. It overwhelmed him and overpowered him entirely. It shocked him to the core. And perhaps, therefore, the angel is given to appear as a man out of sympathy. Some humanity is brought into this to comfort him, to console him, so that the explanation is easier to receive. But that's just a guess. Verse 16, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood. It's Gabriel. And when he came, I was afraid, even appearing as a man. Daniel is in such a susceptible, vulnerable state. I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. At the time of the end. What did he mean? Was he speaking about the end of the waiting time for Messiah? Or was he speaking about the end of the world? What is the vision for? Well, we might be inclined to say, because there's much evidence for this in the passage, of course, it's for the end of the time of the waiting period. Daniel is being told what's going to happen. Two more empires to go, then the empire of the Romans. He's already had that told him in the previous vision. And then Messiah, Antichrist. Messiah will come in chapter 9. So perhaps it's the end of the waiting period for Messiah. World history. What's going to happen to the world? What's going to happen to the Jews? But yet there are things said here which seem much more appropriate to the end of time. So which is right? And I think that the answer is that both are true. The passage has its first fulfillment in the arrival of Antiochus Epiphanes and the terrible sufferings that will be meted out to the Jews. And that will all be a symbol or a picture of what will happen much further down at the very end of the age. So both are probably true. We don't have to make a decision. And there's evidence for that, which given time we'll touch on, but may wait for another study. Verse 18, now as he was speaking with me, the angel Gabriel appearing as a man, I was in a dead sleep on my face toward the ground. But he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. The indignation probably is a term used for the Babylonian captivity. After the captivity, between the end of the 70 years of captivity and the coming of Christ, this is what is going to come to pass. I'll tell you. For at the time appointed, the end shall be. But it's not only ending with the coming of Christ, because the next vision in Daniel chapter 9 will take us right through to the end of time. It's going on. But here is the explanation. And I shall just read these very quickly because we've already considered it. Verse 20, the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. Well, that hadn't happened yet. Daniel would have been astonished to hear that, even as a statesman. Verse 21, and the rough goat, the he-goat, is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king, who we know was Alexander the Great. Verse 22, now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, Alexander the Great's generals, who finally settled on four parts of the kingdom, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power, which might mean not of the same glory as Alexander's days, or it might be not in their power, but only because God permitted it. Verse 23, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, what does that mean? Well, when the Jewish disobedience to God has reached a climax, God will allow a king, this is the little horn, a king of fierce countenance, hardness of face, a cruel man, an understanding dark sentences, great manipulator of cunning strategies and schemes. That's Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, shall stand up. How do we know it's him? Well, we know he followed the four kings. And he did all the things that are prophesied here. So verse 23, you're introduced, well, not introduced, you resume with the little horn. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit, if I can use a strange phrase, about the future history which is here. This isn't just Daniel being told about the time up to the coming of Christ. The two middle empires, the Romans, are not mentioned here. This little hall, the terrible Antiochus Epiphanes. It's not just that. It's more. It's further. Antiochus undoubtedly represents a terrible future enemy of the people of God in New Testament times. We can see there. Well, I'll go over the arguments in a moment. Just look at what Antiochus is going to do. And not all of this was fulfilled in the history of the Jews. Verse 24, and his power shall be mighty, and not by his own power, which implies God will allow it, or it may mean by satanic power, and he shall destroy wonderfully. And the word for wonders is used. It'll be quite astonishing, the terrible things that he does and the evil things that he accomplishes. And he shall prosper and practice and get away with it, that's repeated, for a period of time, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. I've got to tell you, if you're looking at your Bibles, at the end of verse 24, there is no article in the Hebrew. And shall destroy the mighty and holy people. And that's important, because he'll never destroy the remnant. There'll always be a godly remnant preserved by the Lord. He can't destroy the holy people in total. Perhaps our translators have not been so wise as they usually are in inserting an article which isn't in the original. He'll destroy holy people, but by no means all of them. And here is a picture of end times, because Antiochus, as I shall show, does symbolize the final Antichrist. Of course, you should have had a clue about this, because in chapter 7, there is a small horn there. Now, that small horn comes out of the successor kingdoms of the Roman Empire. But it's Antichrist, the Roman Empire, then of course the time of Christ, and right through the Gospel Age, innumerable kingdoms, the 10 kingdoms, and among them the small horn, the Antichrist, who will vex and harass the people of God. And lo and behold, in chapter 8, though it's true, he comes out of the Hellenists, the Greeks, the small horn again, Antiochus. But by getting that name of the small horn is a clue to you that just as the small horn of chapter 7 is Antichrist in the future, the small horn of chapter 8, literally Antiochus Epiphanes, represents and symbolizes the Antichrist into the future. The small horn is your clue. Verse 25, and through his policy, his strategies, he shall cause craft, not in the sense of skills, but in the sense of cunning, to prosper in his hand. And that's exactly what happens. We see the beginnings of it today. We see it in the great apostasy that's going on in the Western world. Never before have we had such hatred of God. In the past, Antichrist, Satan, has majored on false doctrine. The Roman Catholic Church, for example, misleading people, not denying God head on. Of course, there have always been atheists. There has always been antagonism to God. But it's something of recent times that the entire attack of Satan has switched head on to the opposition of God. His being, his existence, his power and attributes, his revelation. Before, yes, we all believe in God, but it's by works, not by grace. It's by the clergy, not by faith and trust in the grace of God and the atoning merits of Christ. Always it's been doctrinal distortion or other religion. Now it's anti-religion. And you've got the hatefulness and the hardness of countenance and the head-on attack that was symbolized in that ferocious attack upon the Jewish people in that 6 or 7 years of Antiochus Epiphanes. This is end times. Through his policy, also he shall cause cunning to prosper. In his hand, he shall magnify himself in his heart. The great magnification of man and his science and his theories and his skills and his wielding of them against God. Did you notice, for instance, with the death of great scientist Stephen Hawking, with his theories in the area of physics and so on, but you notice the publicity after his death and the way it's all conducted? Of course, there was a film made about his life which attracted very considerable sentimental sympathy and support and admiration of him, and no doubt as a person and as a noble sufferer and so on, he has been a great man who is worthy of a considerable degree of admiration, and in his work and as a scientist also, without doubt. But we as Christians very much question his atheistic theories and so on. But you notice how the young are persuaded to admire him without reservation. And I couldn't help being rather taken aback. They were interviewing lots of youngsters, and they were so over the moon. What a great and marvelous and almost infallible person he was. The publicity, the humanistic publicity. They've got to have their great heroes and sing them up. Of course, great as he might have been in many ways, as a thinker and a worker and a sufferer, nevertheless, he's but a man. And in his religious views, or anti-religious views, deeply mistaken. But he's got to be so wonderfully sung about and acclaimed. It's such a pity to see so many young lives bowled over by all this propaganda and brainwashing. But it's what you see here, and I don't mean this as a statement against that particular man personally, but shall magnify himself in his heart. And then you go on, by peace shall destroy many. Peace means prosperity. That's what it leads to. By prosperity, the affluence of end times, the snare of comfort and wealth and the world. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes. Well, of course, he didn't know he was standing against the saviour of the world. He was standing against the Jews and their God and hostile to them. He himself was a pagan. These words cannot be entirely fulfilled until the one comes who Antiochus Epiphanes symbolizes and represents, who consciously will be against the Lord Christ, King of kings and Lord of lords. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And Antiochus was. He was broken by mysterious illness, which led to his death without any attacker or human instrument. Total shock and surprise to all around him. And so it will be with Antichrist. But how interesting the way it's put a little later on. We'll come to it. My time is almost up. Look at verse 26. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore shut thou up the vision. Not make it a secret, but keep it safe. and secure. It's got to be told before the people for years to come. Shut thou up the vision, that it shall be for many days, that it's fully understood and coming to pass. And look at the result. Verse 27, and I, Daniel, fainted. I can't help but think of some of the charismatic imposter people who constantly tell us about their visions. I remember reading about the late John Wimber. He'd be driving along in a car, and God said to me this, and God said to me that, and God showed me this and showed me that. And I said, but God, and he said, you listen to me. Don't interrupt me. And I'll tell you these things clearly. So easily, he drove his car. He was happy, cheerful. Visions came easily. All sorts of things were revealed to him. But it wasn't like that in the Bible to the prophets who really had visions. And I, Daniel, fainted. This was overwhelming. And was sick certain days. Afterward I rose up and did the king's business, Belshazzar's administration. And I was astonished at the vision. But none understood it. He shared it with fellow Jews. But nobody really understood it. He prays a great prayer, which we'll come to in the next chapter. And as a result, he's given even more information. Information so exciting. Information which specifically includes the Messiah and extends to these things, to the age of Messiah. But even here, in this eighth chapter, this vision in the third year of Belshazzar, you get a glimpse of the last days and a final period. Maybe it won't be all that long, but we seem to be moving towards it now. We've never seen such anti-Christian aggression as we're seeing today. This destruction of the Church of God, this attempt on the part of Antichrist to project himself into the church and draw the church down to worldliness and false doctrine and unbelief. The Second Thessalonians Antichrist enters the temple of God as though he is God, supplants all religion, makes scientific humanism or something like it the religion of the day. We're seeing all these things as never before. And the last Antichrist is here. But it's the word of God that is going to be used to destroy Antichrist. Christ will come again and appear, and in the meantime, we destroy him by the word. Individual souls that are delivered from his darkness and clutches, it's by the word of God. Periods of retrenchment, when we have many souls, people of God, Church of Christ, must work through these last days, and the ultimate victory will be ours, a final Satan's little season at the end of time. We'll read about that next study. And then it will be all over. And Christ will come and destroy him with the brightness of his coming. I hope I haven't made it too complex, but this chapter 8 moves towards chapter 9. And we see more about the one who symbolizes the last Antichrist. Let's close this evening singing the hymn 466.